Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any such thing as justice at Guantanamo Bay? Like many Americans, law student Mavash Rukhsana Khan followed media accounts of the prison and worried that its hundreds of detainees might be denied basic legal rights. So she Googled the attorneys working to get Gitmo inmates charged and tried like other suspected criminals and offered to help. As an American born of Afghan parents, Khan spoke fluent Pashto, and her first contribution was as a translator between barred attorneys and their clients. The job put her in a position to not only assist detainees and their lawyers, but to get to know them as individuals, to hear their stories, their insistence of innocence, and their allegations of abuse at the hands of American guards and interrogators. Khan has now graduated to full-fledged attorney and visited clients at Guantanamo more than 30 times. Today, she is convinced that no one she has worked with there could be guilty of terrorist acts. Mavash Rukhsana Khan's new book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Mavash, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of people are sort of distantly concerned about what's going on at Guantanamo Bay. You became convinced that you might actually be able to do something about it. Can you talk about how your obsession started to grow?
Well, initially I got involved at Guantanamo as a law student. I was taking an international law class, and at the time I had no idea whether the prisoners were innocent or guilty, and my desire really had more to do with the legal principles at stake, and I just became outraged about the things that I was learning, that our administration had essentially created this lawless state, and it was sort of a black hole where people, men, were being taken and never charged and being held seemingly indefinitely. And I was also baffled that policymakers were debating the legality of these very medieval torture techniques because, you know, really once upon a time it was Chinese water torture, and today in America it's waterboarding. And so that's how the obsession began, and I Googled the cases that I was studying and found out who had taken them to the Supreme Court and got in touch with those attorneys and sort of got my foot in the door as an interpreter.
Those attorneys were attempting to help inmates challenge their detention, essentially. Can you talk a little bit about the history of habeas corpus as a fundamental legal right, not just in this country, but elsewhere?
Sure. Habeas corpus predates the Magna Carta. It's enshrined in our Constitution. And essentially, it is, I mean, we're asking for either to be told why the prisoners are being held and charged or to let them go. And it goes all the way back to England, and it's enshrined in the principles that our country was founded upon.
Talk for a minute about your initial expectations before you went, what you thought it would be like there.
Well, when I initially went to the military base and before I met the prisoners, I was very nervous because I went there thinking I was going to meet somebody who was Taliban or Al-Qaeda or a terrorist, you know, everything we'd heard about in the media about the worst of the worst. And so I was very nervous, and I remember going into that meeting room and seeing somebody, there was a man across the room who was shackled to the floor, and he looked just as nervous as I was. And I walked in, and he looked at me and smiled, and I smiled back, and I gave him the universal Islamic greeting, which translates to "May peace be upon you." And he responded, and I walked over and shook hands with my first terrorist. And the more I learned about this guy, the military called him 1154, and his name was Dr. Ali Shah, and he was a pediatrician. He had worked for the United Nations to help increase Afghan electoral support in the new democracy that the U.S. Helped create. And his wife was an economist. He'd fled the Taliban to Iran as a refugee because he didn't want his daughter and children to grow up under that oppressive hand. And everything that I learned about him, just it didn't make sense. How this man could possibly be there.
And one of the things that you discovered throughout your research was that in many cases there were really large cash bounties placed, put out there for turning in anyone that could have been associated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda.
Exactly. I think most people, including myself initially, assume that, you know, they must have done something to have been there. But I became convinced that so many mistakes could very easily have been made once I learned about the bounties. And what the U.S. military did when they went over there is airdrop thousands of bounty leaflets offering up to $25,000 per Taliban and al-Qaeda. And in a place like Afghanistan, where the average Afghan makes 80 cents a day, which is about $300 a year, that's like winning the Super Lotto jackpot. And Afghanistan is a lawless country with feuds that go back generations based on politics and ethnic tribal affiliations. And offering a bounty program of that extent without following it up with investigations created this huge market for people to hand their enemies over. And there was a huge financial incentive that was created with these bounty programs. And according to unclassified DOD documents, after the Associated Press sued under the Freedom of Information Act, we learned that 86% of the detainees at Guantanamo were turned in at a time when locals had were gaining financially through the bounty program.
Mavash Rukhsana Khan is my guest. She's an attorney and a journalist. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Did you go into this, Mavash, expecting that you would publish your diary or your notes?
No, I didn't. I went in as a law student trying to preserve these legal rights, and the first people that I met with, you know, there was a pediatrician and an 80-year-old paraplegic, and at that point I knew I wanted to share what I had learned, and I wrote an article that had published in the Washington Post about that, and the space just wasn't enough, and that's where the book came into play.
Had you promised that you wouldn't write anything about what you learned there?
No, I never promised that I wouldn't write anything. I was banned from the base after I published the Washington Post article because I had included a photograph of the sun rising over the hills in Guantanamo and a picture of a soldier. And the procedure for clearing notes was, after every meeting, anything that the detainees would tell us is presumed classified, and we would write it down and hand it over to the Department of Defense, who would review all of it and either hand it back cleared or uncleared. And the cleared notes became published in my book.
Several of the people that you met with described really shocking kinds of physical and mental abuse at the hands of American interrogators and also, in some cases, simply the guards. Can you talk about the sort of patterns that you would hear about?
Sure. A lot of the abuse that I firsthand heard was from Dr. Ali Shah, the pediatrician, and Haji Nasrat. And they spoke
That was the 80-year-old man. Sorry to
interrupt
you. Yes,
the 80-year-old paraplegic who couldn't walk. He'd suffered two strokes before he had come to Guantanamo 15 years before, and so he was bedridden and paralyzed. And Dr. Ali Shah described, before he came to Guantanamo at Bagram, being at Bagram Air Base is north of Kabul in Afghanistan, and it's run by the U.S. military. And a lot of the detainees in Guantanamo come initially from there. And they described beatings, extremes of heat and cold, being doused with ice water. The doctor said that he was deprived of sleep for weeks on end. I mean, to the point, and they would make him stand in different positions, and it would be to the point where he couldn't, you know, hold himself up, and he would fall down because his legs were so weak from standing and the lack of sleep, and they'd beat him again, being stripped, herded around like cattle, dragged around, I mean, all sorts of things. And the old man described being beaten by U.S. soldiers and having his arm injured. And the tales of torture and abuse, I mean, a lot of people, yes, they will say that these people are trained to lie and they've learned it from al-Qaeda training manuals, but this is detainee after detainee, and it's corroborated by the Red Cross, by, you know, retired Army General Antonia Tabuga went to Abu Ghraib and described similar patterns. And these are individuals often, Amnesty International, the Red Cross, so it's been corroborated.
Did you see evidence of physical abuse ongoing?
The only evidence that I saw were anecdotal from the detainees. I mean, I didn't see physical injuries, if that's what you're asking.
Did you worry, Mavash, as a practicing Muslim in this era when people are so quick, unfortunately, to act on their fears and on their prejudices, that your interest in preserving the rights of the Guantanamo detainees might be misinterpreted as somehow disloyal to American interests?
I do worry about that, and I still worry about that people perceive me as being anti-American, but I am American, and I got involved because I care about the future well-being of my country, which was once celebrated for its justice and for our legal system, and I feel that it's every American's duty as a patriot to speak up when you feel that your government is doing something that is tarnishing your country, because there's a big difference between the U.S. government administration and the American people and our country. And I think I'm being patriotic in standing up for what I believe America was founded for.
How did your mom and dad feel when you told them what you were going to do?
They were very supportive. I grew up in my mom's an activist, and they're both physicians, but I remember growing up and my mom was always politically active with, you know, the war in Bosnia or different civil, she encouraged me to be involved in society and civic engagement. So they were supportive. I eventually went to Afghanistan, and they weren't supportive of that because they felt that it was violent, and I was going on behalf of the detainees to collect exonerating evidence and to help back up their stories and give that evidence to the military. But my parents were a little iffy about those trips.
Yeah, your parents worked very hard to make sure that you had a sense of your culture, of their culture, when you were growing up in the United States. I'm wondering if before you went to Afghanistan, if you thought, oh, I understand the culture, I'm gonna be completely familiar with everything here, and if there were things that took you by surprise when you actually entered Afghanistan.
My parents were definitely keen on making sure we were tied to our heritage, and they didn't want us to lose that growing up in America. So we always spoke Pashto at home. And when I went to Afghanistan, I guess what surprised me was the hospitality of the people. And it was a much more beautiful country than I'd seen in pictures and heard stories of. But little things that I didn't initially understand, like, you know, sometimes men wouldn't look at me and I couldn't, or shake my hand, or they would look but look away. And a few of the detainees did that, and I initially didn't understand. And going to Afghanistan helped me because the locals were very respectful, men and women. They always invited me in and, you know, insisted I stay for meals and were very hospitable. But the men, I think that local women sometimes might feel like they're being ogled, or there's just barrier restrictions that I wasn't used to, but I didn't feel that I was being disrespected as a woman, which I think some people might interpret that as.
Mavash Rukhsana Khan is my guest. She's an attorney and a journalist. Her new book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. After the break, we will talk more to Mavash, including talking about how she gained the trust of the clients that she worked with at Guantanamo Bay. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney and journalist Mavash Rukhsana Khan. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I think the overwhelming sort of story that seems to repeat throughout the book, Mavash, is how much these men miss their families. Can you talk about the amount of human contact they have at any one time?
They're not allowed to call their families, and their letters are generally censored. So a lot of times when their children write to them, it's covered in black censor strokes. So beyond that, a lot of them are held in solitary confinement in these 7 by 8 foot concrete boxes, basically, which is about a little bit bigger than a king-size mattress. It's in that space is their bed, their toilet. A lot of them eat every meal alone. And so the human contact is it's not what they're used to.
And some of them, you've said, only see the sun every few weeks.
That's correct. Some of them are taken out for recreation for an hour or two every day, sometimes in the middle of the night. And so they're taken out and, woken up in the middle of the night, and they never see sunlight for long periods of time.
Some critics of your work have said you're naive to believe what they're saying, and you've alluded to this before earlier, and it's something that you initially sort of struggled with. Is there part of you that thinks perhaps they're simply chastened by the experience of having been in captivity and that they, in their natural milieu, would behave in a really different way from what you observed?
Well, I had thought about that, and I wondered. However, I've visited some of the detainees back home after they've been released to Afghanistan, and their personalities are absolutely consistent. I mean, Dr. Ali Shah was the same very hospitable, respectful, incredibly polite guy. Haji Nusrat was also released, and he was the same grumpy old man who, ordered his sons around, and their stories were consistent. The doctor set up his clinics. He was a pediatrician. He really did want to return to Afghanistan after the Taliban fell. And the old man told me consistently that they supported Karzai, and his son was a senator in his regime. So, and it was detainee after detainee stories like that, and I found them consistent. I'm not saying that everybody at Guantanamo is innocent, because I don't believe that, and certainly there are bad people at Guantanamo. We've heard of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some of the high-value detainees. However, without a fair trial and without giving them a voice, which every murderer and rapist in America has, you can't separate the good from the bad. And the attorneys aren't even fighting for all of these men to be released, simply that they should have the basic rights to be charged and to have a trial and to do things openly so that there aren't these mistakes. Because when there isn't transparency, you have, bad people being let go and 80-year-olds who haven't done anything and not understand why they're being imprisoned. And that's the takeaway from this.
Given those conditions, it would seem difficult for any of the detainees to trust anyone that they were suddenly told was there to help them, including, a really idealistic young translator and hopeful attorney. What did it take for you to develop enough of a relationship to get them to talk to you and to trust you?
Well, I believe that some of them were starved for some semblance of culture, because it had been years since they'd seen their families and anything from home. And so I went there, and these men have been reduced to numbers. The guards don't even know their names. They're known as they're serial numbered, they're dressed alike, and they've become these inanimate sort of things, which I think makes their abuse more palatable. And I wanted to try to give them a semblance of their culture back, and so I would do little things like bring them Starbucks chai, because chai is, it was the closest thing to what they drank back home. And I cooked for them. I found out what their favorite meals were. And And we learned a lot about each other. They were curious about my family and how I could have possibly been Muslim growing up in America. And so they would quiz me about, you know, religion. And there was a lot of interfaith dialogue between the attorneys and the detainees. And beyond that, the book is also sort of a behind-the-scenes take on relationships and friendships and betrayal. It's not just about torture. And through my meetings with the detainees and our back and forth ideas of East and West, I also got a better understanding of my ancestral homeland. And I think through these discussions, which were not always legal, there developed a trust and a deep friendship between myself and the detainees, as well as a lot of the attorneys and their clients.
When you say they were not always legal, I want to clarify. You mean they were not illegal. You mean they were not always about the legal process that you were there to sort of put
exactly
in place.
Okay. Right. Sometimes it was just, you know, talk about, you know, attorneys asking their clients how they could possibly have two wives and how they juggle that, and and detainees asking questions about, you know, how why Americans drink to the point of impaired judgment. And there's a lot of back and forth, just dialogue that we never hear about in the press. And I think a lot of that helps with the trust and the communication. It's just treating them like human beings.
It really is an interesting journey that you take, having always felt somewhat on the outside because of your parents' very traditional ways, at least compared with your friends whose parents were not immigrants. And then you also get to realize how very American you are in some ways when they're asking you to recite phrases from the Quran and you're having
right
to like think back to Sunday school.
Right. Well, they would quiz me. They didn't believe that I could possibly be Muslim, so, you know, they wanted me to sort of prove it to them. But I did have this East-West culture dilemma, and I grew to really appreciate my heritage as well as my American freedoms and the balance that I've sort of created for myself. And the detainees strengthened my own desire to go back to Afghanistan and see all of that. And I admire them for, I was just often so in awe of how dignified some of them tried to maintain themselves despite the constant humiliation, the series of, you know, full cavity searches on and being stripped. And yet they tried to maintain their pride. And they were, you know, some of them were very inspiring people.
Are they angry?
And I would say without a doubt, some of them must be. I couldn't imagine that they wouldn't. When I visited Haji Nasrath, the 80-year-old back home, he was released after a little over three years in Guantanamo without being charged. And the first question that he had for me was whether I could help him get a visa to come to America. And I thought it was a joke. I was like, you know, why don't you go to France or England? And why do you want to go to America? And his response was, you know, he wanted medical treatment because of the paralysis that he'd suffered from a stroke, and he couldn't get that in Afghanistan. And he just, you know, he went on this tirade about how he never believed that he was in Guantanamo because of the fault of Americans, but he believed that he was sold into captivity by local Afghans and that it was the American military's mistake not to investigate, but that he didn't believe that he was maliciously imprisoned by them. And he didn't harbor resentment. I don't know if he harbored resentment, but he didn't seem angry. He had his son worked in the New Democracy, and he really wanted to come to America. Unfortunately, he's still classified as an enemy combatant, so I doubt the visa thing would work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. My guest is Mavash Rukhsana Khan. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Vita in Addison asks, when you went to Afghanistan, did you find that they hate Americans? What did they know about Guantanamo, and what did they think about Obama or McCain?
I didn't hear a lot about Obama or McCain in Afghanistan. I did not find that they hated Americans. I found that, you know, there was kind of a fascination by the West among some circles. They wore Western clothes. They like jeans, and, you know, there were shopping centers that had been built in Kabul where they sold U2 edition iPods and things like that. But there was also, among other Afghans, a resentment of the very obvious military presence of the U.S. in Afghanistan. They were grateful that the Taliban had been toppled, and they were grateful for the construction being made. But at the same time, they're very proud people, and I got the feeling that they at some point would want the military presence to subside. That was the feeling that I got.
We talked earlier about getting your clients to sort of trust you. Were there some that you trusted more easily than others?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes. There were some who I instantly knew were good, and the friendship developed much more quickly. There were others, it took a while, because there were some who, you know, wouldn't make a lot of eye contact, and I think it's just cultural differences between how conservative certain people are versus others. And some, you know, there was one guy who was a goat herder, and he said he was a goat herder, and I never believed his story about being a goat herder because he seemed much more sophisticated. He, you know, could read and write English flawlessly, and he said he had learned English at Guantanamo. But I don't believe necessarily that there was no evidence of him being Al-Qaeda or anything of that sort, and it was never proven that he was. And he, the trust came. It took a while longer with him, but he was released, and I've been in touch. And nothing that I haven't learned of anything to suggest that he had ever done anything against the United States.
So, in other words, you couldn't believe the story about being a goat herder, but you don't...
necessarily believe. I mean, there was nothing to suggest that he was Al-Qaeda. The reason he said he was there was because his cousin, Ismail, had worked with the U.S. military in Kunar, Afghanistan, which is where he was from, and he was setting up water lines because the U.S. was helping the locals with the water issue, and a lot of the locals didn't have water. And so they got into a fight because his house didn't get the water pipe, and his cousin turned him over. And the locals supported the story, and he was pronounced as, you know, being Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but there was never any evidence to suggest, and this issue with his cousin came up in the military hearing, and the presiding officer told him to stay away from his cousin when he went back home because, you know, it had gotten him into trouble. But there were just so many instances like that where you wondered how these people got there.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience with the people who worked at the prison, the guards and other military personnel? I remember reading you were sort of surprised to find that most of them seemed like decent people.
Yes. I went to Guantanamo with two biases. One, that all of the detainees would be terrorists and Al-Qaeda and bomb makers, and the second one was that all the guards would be hostile and, you know, aloof, not very nice. And I found that I was wrong on both cases because a lot of the guards were very nice people. I keep in touch with some of them over email. A lieutenant colonel and another one asked me to help, you know, proofread his English papers. And I just found that a lot of them were just young kids trying to find their way and doing what they believed was right and following instructions.
But then an attorney that you worked with cautioned you about too easily accepting the fact that they were genuinely good.
Yes, there was an attorney, and I made a comment on that first trip about, you know, how deceived I had felt about the detainees because they weren't what I had expected, and equally with the guards. They were teaching me how to play pool, and you know, they were very nice, and he was quick to point out that the entire Guantanamo operation was evil and that made comments about, you know, the face of evil often not being that being of a friend. And I don't think he was speaking specifically of the guards, but just generally.
Did you have to apply that? And it was something that you write really sort of stuck with you. Did you have to apply that to the detainees as well? Or are they in such a different situation that in your mind that didn't really go to that situation?
No, I mean, I believe that there are bad people as well as good ones at Guantanamo. I mean, we've heard about the high-value detainees, though they were all brought in on Guantanamo's fifth anniversary and sort of paraded before the press that, hey, we do have bad guys here. I do feel that there are, you know, good and bad have all been swept together. And my personal experience has been meeting detainees who I don't believe have ever done anything against the United States, that there was never any evidence to suggest that. I have read their files, gone back to Afghanistan. My own client is a real estate agent and a car dealer, and I didn't know whether his story was true or not, and only a trial could prove that. But when I went back to Afghanistan and I met locals, I was able to collect land title deeds that went back, you know, years, and cars that he had sold, and bring this evidence back to show. And the book's point is not everybody here is innocent and let them all go, but have a trial, let them present evidence, let them bring witnesses, and if you can prove that they're terrorists, or if you can charge them with anything, lock them up after that. But until then, it's against what we stand for.
A significant portion of the detainees that are at Guantanamo now are actually Yemeni nationals, and there have been some sort of extradition talks between the U.S. and Yemen that have stalled. Does that surprise you?
I'm not in a position to comment about the Yemeni detainees because I'm not familiar with that. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Mavash Ruksana Khan is my guest. She's an attorney and a journalist. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. We'll return in a moment to our conversation. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or do it via email. That goes to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney and journalist Mavash Ruksana Khan. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's go now to Donnie in Louisville. Hi, Donnie.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm enjoying the show. I was just wondering if your panelist had a comment about whether or not there's any criminal activity that may come up against the Bush administration and what the fallout or liability may be to the United States when this all winds up being over. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I believe that the fallout and liability is it's definitely tarnished the image of the United States. We're not a model for developing nations anymore by torturing prisoners and creating this lawless zone outside of the United States that is Guantanamo. And I think that Guantanamo also is the face of a much larger system of prisons that are outside of any jurisdiction. And we often don't hear about the prisoners in those prisons, the CIA black sites all over the world.
I'm curious about your Pashto. Very often when Americans speak their parents' language at home other than English, they're not necessarily formally educated in that second language. Have there been words or phrases that you had never had to really think about before that are hard to convey in either Pashto or English that you've had to use?
Yes, and beyond that, I speak Pashto with an American accent. Mm-hmm. It was very obvious to the detainees when I walked in, and they thought it was kind of cute. And they were like, "Oh, you know, you're speaking English in Pashto." But beyond that, words like enemy combatant, I didn't know how to say, but I described it. And Pashto is a very simplistic language. It's kind of tribal in that sense where the word for enemy combatant was really enemy fighter, just translated. And I was able to quickly pick up on the terminology like that. But and the other thing with Pashto is there's different dialects, and I quickly found that they're mostly mutually intelligible. I mean, the words sound a little bit different depending on what area you're from, but I was able to deal with that pretty well, and my Pashto's improved with it.
Did you have to call your parents for help at any point?
Before I went down with some technical legal words that I wasn't sure about, for example, I didn't know how to say the U.S. Supreme Court. And I realized that it was very simple in Pashto because they'll just say, you know, the biggest court or the highest. Because really, when we hear the term, for example, loya jirga, it means a big gathering. And Pashto is very simplistic in that sense. So speaking it, even when you're talking about complicated terms, isn't that difficult.
And how did the transition work for you when you went from being an interpreter who was in law school to officially being an attorney who had a client of her own to represent?
I have one client now, and I was supervised while with a corporate attorney who I also interpret for. But the transition went fine because I had sat in on so many attorney-client meetings interpreting that I sort of learned the drill, and I'd gone to Afghanistan for this client, and I gathered evidence on his behalf and explained what I was doing. And so I think that with the attorneys around me, I was able to transition pretty smoothly into that.
I have to imagine that your experience while you were still in school made you the envy of your classmates. Were your professors also really curious about what you were learning?
They were curious, and they were also very supportive because I kept taking so many trips to Guantanamo as a third-year law student, and I was able to drop certain classes with attendance policies, and the dean allowed me to get credit for my work at Guantanamo. So it worked out well, and they were all very supportive.
Was this already your focus in terms of your studies before you took this on, or had you decided what you wanted to specialize in?
I was actually in the midst of applying to corporate law firms when I was in this international law class, and I was interviewing with, you know, for securities positions. So it was completely the other side. It was a type of law that I'd always wanted to go into, but didn't exactly know where, and it just fell into place.
So now you're there for good.
I don't know what I'll do after I'm in California, and I will be taking the California bar, and I hope to continue working on a human rights level, but we'll see where.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Mavash Rukhsana Khan. Her book is called My Guantanamo Diary. Let's speak next to Hilda in Dallas. Hi, Hilda.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
Very interesting show. I would like to find out who is paying for the attorney's fees to defend the Guantanamo Bay people, and who is paying also for her. Oh, my God, I am so scared. And who is paying for her trips to Afghanistan?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
The representation of Guantanamo detainees is largely taken on pro bono by corporate attorneys, and they do it out of pocket. There are also lots of federal defenders, and they're paid by the U.S. government, and the federal defenders are salaried, and they also take part in the representation of Guantanamo detainees. Furthermore, there are solo practitioners, law professors, who generally all volunteer their time. And my financing has been through the attorneys that I work with who pay me. And regarding the trips to Afghanistan, I financed those on my own because it would have been a liability for the firms to send me there because of the political climate.
If I read properly, the clients that you interpreted for had no one who spoke both Pashto and English before. How were they communicating with their attorneys?
They weren't. That was my first trip to the base was the first time a Pashto Afghan detainee was met by an attorney. So it was a great resource.
Was this something that no one paid for an interpreter to come, or could one literally not be found? There have to be other Afghan descendants in the country.
There have been more interpreters found, but I guess it. There were issues with clearance, and the clearance process took about 6 months. And FBI background checks, they pull every piece of your credit, your grades. They talk to my deans, every neighbor that I've ever lived next to, and that's hard to do when you have lived outside of the country, for example. And possibly some of the interpreters have had a lot of family in Afghanistan or other countries, and it's hard to do those background checks in a timely way when everything's kind of spread out.
Is it any harder to get information that you need from the government in this case than it would be for any other case, as far as maybe the attorneys that you work with have been concerned?
To get information from the government?
In other words, is the government really sharing everything it knows? I suppose if it hasn't filed charges, it's obviously not necessarily required to present evidence.
No, the government generally doesn't provide evidence, and they, for example, initially, when we first heard about Guantanamo, nobody knew how many people were there, what their names were, what their nationalities were, and the Associated Press sued the U.S. government for that information under the Freedom of Information Act, and with that, we've learned more. But it's also often been a court battle after court battle to make these little steps towards learning new things about, the process and the procedures and how things are done.
It does seem that little by little the courts are sort of taking the wind out of the sails of the existence of Guantanamo Bay. Do you think there will be a time in the near future when it's not an option for arrestees to be warehoused there?
In Guantanamo?
Yeah.
I do believe so. I don't believe that the great majority will ever receive a trial in the United States. I believe that they will probably be sent home before that. The transfers back to their home countries have increased leading up to the Supreme Court decision, which said that they had a right to habeas corpus. And I think it would just shame the U.S. government further if Americans could see in public trials in U.S. courts who they have imprisoned. It's possible the high-value detainees would be kept there and potentially given trials here, but I don't see it happening for people like pediatricians and school teachers, because there's a lot of those, and it would just bring further shame to the U.S. government to have an open trial. And I believe that most of those guys will be transferred back to their home countries before they ever see a day in court.
Is there any compensation whatsoever for the ones who are sent home and told, oh, we were wrong, you haven't done anything?
A lot of them have spoken about that, and they would like to be compensated for lost wages, wrongful arrest, all of that. The problem is the U.S. government has maintained the position that the reason why they are there is classified information, and to disclose that would be an issue of national security. And so trials like that, it would seem complicated and difficult to go forward.
Can you talk about the kinds of access you had and the things you were able to see and compare it with what you know to be the case for journalists who have been allowed into the facility?
Well, journalists who are allowed at Guantanamo are given sort of this Mickey Mouse tour of the detention center. They're shown a model cell, and the military tells them, gives them their rundown of what life is like. And they are never allowed to sit down with a detainee. No journalist has ever had access to any Guantanamo prisoner, has never interviewed one. And that was the perpetual question of Haji Nusrat. You know, why aren't journalists allowed in here? Why can't they interview us? Why am I being hidden in Guantanamo? Because if I've done something, you know, show me to the world, give me a public trial. But the things that I've written about, journalists have not had access to.
What were you told about what to be careful of? Were you prepared by the military before you sort of set foot on Guantanamo in terms of security? And were you told about certain things that would and would not be allowed?
Generally, we were briefed on how to handle classified information. Everything that we learned from the detainees was presumed classified, and they gave us a briefing on, you know, if we spoke about classified information, it had to be with the blinds closed to prevent lip reading of people outside. And when we ran Xerox copies of classified documents, it had to be in the secured facility on special copiers and all sorts of procedures like that and just general base rules.
Is there any reason that you can think of why the United States needs to have a facility like Guantanamo at Guantanamo off U.S. soil completely?
The only reason that Guantanamo, the detention center, is at Guantanamo Bay is to avoid U.S. jurisdiction and to avoid being held accountable under any laws, because there have been terror suspects who have been tried on U.S. soil in the past, who have been imprisoned in U.S. soil. I mean, the World Trade Center bombing, the first one, those terror suspects were tried and convicted on U.S. soil. And we have ways of, you know, dealing with protected information and classified documents. And so the whole arena of these secret prisons and secrecy is a way of getting around the law. And that's essentially why they're there. So the public does not know who is there. And we are told that they're all, you know, bomb makers and the worst of the worst. And if Americans, I believe, could see who was really at Guantanamo, I don't believe that it would have been open as long as it has been.
Does the fact that you and other attorneys have been able to practice there tell you at least there is an effort, or do you think you're there mostly for show in terms of the government's ability to let you be there?
Well, the government did not fought attorneys getting involved, and that was a Supreme Court decision in 2004. And since attorneys have started coming to Guantanamo, the detainees have now, other detainees have been kept in Bagram and other secret prisons. So the numbers have started dwindling, and I think the government is not in favor of the detainees.
Mavash Rukhsana Khan's book is called My Guantanamo Diary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.